Thank you for three really fantastic papers. I think I've got quite a job if I try and join them all together in a way that does justice to them, so I'm afraid I won't be able to do that. But I'm just going to pick out some of the questions that are raised for me personally by all the papers. And the theme that emerges for me from all the different papers is about the historical, technological and plural character of the aesthetic, perhaps just because they're three quite disparate papers, so the kind of plurality of the aesthetic is what I want to think about, and the historical and technological composition of the aesthetic. So starting with Partha's paper, Partha's talking about the plurality of the of aesthetics, that there are East aesthetics of the East and West, that aesthetics not only exists in plural forms in multiple cultures, but also that it's constituted through the coming together and bringing together of multiple cultures, the dialogic conception of culture. And I think Partha argues very convincingly that we shouldn't think about the kind of modern meeting of East and Western cultures in terms of a domination, or just in terms of a kind of flow from the West to the East, and shouldn't therefore think about that encounter as a context of homogenization, but rather a multiplying of encounters and plurality. Now, I agree with all that. I find that very convincing. A question that raises that it raises for me, however, in relation to the issue of homogenization, is to think about not only homogenization as potentially the West dominating the East, the imposition of one culture on another, but also the idea that the mediatization of cultures, the particular adoptions and developments of technologies, can itself be homogenizing, and that it can be possible that neither do we have a situation in which the East is dominating the West or the West is dominating the East, but still we have a process of homogenization because of the technological production of culture. And I'm thinking particularly, I suppose, of the arguments of Walter Benjamin that the introduction of technological reproducibility produces particular possibilities of culture and destroys a lot of possibilities of culture, destroys the aura, destroys particular traditions. So when I think of the judges and the spectacle, Leslie's raised for us the issue of, does the kind of power of the spectacle of the judges, is that declining or in question in this context? And it seems to me that one really important aspect of that is the fact that we can produce those clothes in mass production, that you imagine what that kind of gilded embroidery meant, the spectacular effect of it 300 years ago, 400 years ago, as opposed to now when we could buy something that looked very, very much like that for not very much money. So there's a kind of technological a possibility that the kind of modern coming together is homogenizing or not, but because of technological parameters of culture. So that would be a question for you if you wanted to answer it. It's not necessarily do you think is it homogenizing, but what do you see as the role of technology and mediatization in these terms? Moving on to Louise's paper. Now, Louise, I had the great privilege of reading the whole chapter, which was fantastic and I enjoyed very much. Unfortunately, I had kind of decided to respond to a bit of the paper that wasn't what you then talked about, which was the discussion of quantum physics. But so hopefully this will still sort of make sense, and I tried to just jig in a little bit. Walter Benjamin or Marxist theory in general sort of talks about technological reproduction, mass production, as something that shapes and transforms the possibilities of culture. We know that in more recent scholarship, particularly Foucault, There's a real attention to how biological reproduction and sciences of reproductive life have changed the ground of possibilities of aesthetics and of politics, of organisations, of the sensible organisations of associational life, as Louise puts it. And Louise draws our attention to Hogarth's line of beauty as a kind of aesthetic enactment of that difference that's made in the historical reconstitution and creating of new possibilities of aesthetics and an organisation. In the part of the paper that Louise didn't talk about, she talks about quantum physics and the introduction of different notions of causation, that causation can happen or that you can have action at a distance and mysterious causation or one thing causing another without an obvious local cause, as something that kind of adds to, again, a new layer, I think, of possibility of how we organise the sensible. And Louise argues there that that when we think about biopolitics, when we think about bios and life, that we shouldn't just think about that in terms of biological life and biological reproduction, but also in terms of the kind of liveliness and disruptive capacity of things, which brings us back into what we did talk about, which is excellent. That we should think about the bios as incorporating kind of inanimate, which I guess they couldn't then be inanimate, but the lively capacity of things. That raised for me the question of what does that mean for resistance in thinking about the kind of whole idea of biopolitics and thinking about security as biopolitical creates a way of thinking about how we do political resistance, which is to say that we do political resistance by arguing about contesting what constitutes life. So whereas you can think about kind of bourgeois politics as talking of, as a claim that the bourgeoisie is the vital driver of life of the nation, socialism as a kind of challenge to that by saying, no, actually the vital force of the nation is the working class. So it raised for me the question of where does Louise's analysis leave us in terms of thinking the possibilities of resistance? If life is something that includes both inanimate life and all these different things. And I think Louise certainly addressed that question actually in the presentation today, to say that resistance is contained in this kind of disruptive capacity, the breaking up of aesthetics, and the kind of Rancièrean argument. But I think Louise is actually saying something maybe more interesting than Rancière, actually, in that it's not just about things being disrupted and thrown up in the air, but about the necessity to think life, the ground of politics, differently, to think networked, associational life differently. So if I've understood that correctly, that it's about a kind of profound political potential and capacity contained in reimagining and reperforming what constitutes life as networked associational life. So having answered one question already for me, it did leave me with another question for you, Louise, which was that I wasn't sure I was wholly convinced that about the utility of collapsing together these different forms of life politics and saying this is all part of biopolitics. If it's not about biopolitical racism as the kind of central security problem, then isn't it more useful for us analytically to be talking about additional aesthetics, additional, whether it's molecular politics or however you want to conceive of it? So finally, and I'm aware of not trying to take up too much time, to come back to Les's paper. And coming back to this issue of the historicity and technologically produced nature of different aesthetics and different authorities. So with the sort of expecting pictures of judges behind him, concertina. Yeah, so I suppose just to come back to this idea of sort of judicial authority as being created through spectacle that Les has talked about, and a spectacle that perhaps is challenged by a kind of alternative spectacle of capital, and I think I'd also want to suggest challenged by the kind of technological undermining of the uniqueness of those productions. What I was led to think about when reading your paper was about, well, is it really, is the authority of the contemporary judiciary, how much is that vested in a kind of spectacular aesthetics and a development of the awe of the judiciary? And how much is that actually quite a different logic of authority, the kind of bureaucratic authority that somebody like Weber talks about? The authority of the law is so much vested in its universality and its mundanity and the impartiality of kind of a bureaucratic process. And if it is, how is that something we can explore the aesthetics of? How is that bureaucracy and everydayness and mundanity performed? Or can we even look at aesthetics when they're not spectacle? And so finally, a question sort of for everybody is about the plurality of aesthetics. Does talking about or performing or constituting a plural aesthetics enable a pluralization of power? Is there something democratizing in that? And if so, what is the role of our kind of scholarship in talking about exploring aesthetics in recognizing or affirming that kind of pluralization? So I don't know how much that made sense, but
that was terrific. Thanks very much, Claire, for opening up lots of lines of discussion and debate. Obviously, I'd like the panelists to have an opportunity to respond to some of Claire's comments, but perhaps we could hold off just for the moment and invite people around the table to chip in with any thoughts, comments, questions, if you could indicate in the usual way. Mike first, then Jenny.
I thought that all the talks and the response were terrific, and I want to ask something. I'm quite sure what this question is, but it refers mostly to Louise, I think, but perhaps goes a little further. I'm wondering about being rendered perceptible. In my very imperfect French, I think the partage de la sensible is kind of distribution of perceptibility, distribution of the perceptible, perceptibility. And of course, being perceptible might not just involve visuality and sight, but being seen. This is the way I think you mostly unpack it, and we often do unpack it. Of course, you can be perceptible through a combination of one or more of the five senses. So you shouldn't be kind of spooked by visuality as your primary one. But if being rendered perceptible may be empowering or disempowering, this is one thing I'm struck by thinking also about what the other two speakers have said as well. Being rendered perceptible by the machine which shows your presence as somebody who is a citizenly object of protection or perhaps a danger to citizenly order. It's a bit like theories of representation. You are brought into perceptibility in a particular way that renders you. There is a particular, very narrow, selective part of you, maybe even not part of you, which is the thing, the lens through which one is rendered perceptible, visually more or less in this case, or there might be red lights going off and flashing at some sort of machine, so it might be audible as well. But of course you can be rendered relatively powerless or disempowered too by being absent from that perceptibility. And I think of the absence of citizens for whom justice is being done, presumably in the pedestrian is a lovely word, incidentally, and lovely double or possible triple meaning. So I simply wanted to ask, or possibly just to rant briefly, about perceptibility rather than sensible or in any kind of straight translation. I'm sure you appreciate that point. That it's not just visuality, and there is a kind of complex, multi-sided relationship between empowering and disempowering, and being rendered perceptible and being kept invisible or rendered invisible. I'm using the visual thing myself there, but rendered imperceptible. which just struck me as a link to the way that different speakers this morning were beginning to unpack and to show us how this might work.
Okay, thanks very much, Mike. First to Jenny, and then we'll take some more.
Okay, mine is mainly for Louise as well, and I'm also not quite sure whether it's a question or a comment, or whether it's completely beside the point. But I was very interested in the way you were talking about the hollowing out of content and the focus on form, which for me immediately raises the possibility of, well, okay, let's put back the content, let's make things more specific, let's get down to specifics, not generalise, and therefore the randomness and the excess can come out. But then I was thinking back to our conversation earlier about the analogue and the digital, and I was wondering whether what you're pointing to is various different ways of using the digital as opposed to the analogue. And so this is sort of returning to your question about associative life. I'm becoming totally coherent, never mind. Carry on. For me, digitization recalls things like separation and a sort of atomism, which is the opposite of associative life in a way. It's a starting from separation and so on. So in a way, maybe the way that we're already thinking is in digitized form.
Yeah.
So we're thinking digital, and now we're practicing digital as well. And to go back then to the form and the content, maybe that separation is in the same ballpark. So I've always been suspicious of that separation between form and content, and maybe that separation is part of what enables us to think separation or digitization in the first place. So that's, I'd be really interested in your thoughts on that.
One more question.
Yes, very quickly, also for Louise. I wondered if it's worth situating aesthetics in a conversation about work and organisation. Because I can see this sort of attraction when you go back to Hogarth. But when I think about the situated context in which beauty is constructed for these programmers,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they are probably from, you know, different parts of the world, depending on who you're interviewing, and then they have in their own work on organisation the traditions of learning and the exercise of craft a certain constitution of beauty, and while we may see parallels and forms of patterning with Hogarth, I think the specifics of what they bring to bear is important to pay attention to. Otherwise, we are ourselves universalizing and historicizing the situation. And I can see the attraction of using the tool, but sometimes that's his limit point. And finally, just to Partha, wanted to say, C.L.R. James, Beyond the Boundary, cricket, all of that obviously takes into politics, aesthetics, art, and the problematic but also productive exchange that you'd like us to pay attention to.
Okay, can I invite the panellists to respond to those questions and Claire's comments, and then hopefully there'll be time for one round before coffee. Okay, so should we go in the order?
I'm just looking at the programme and thinking maybe we can just do without breaking for coffee and people can just get coffee, because we just have to otherwise we'll be late for lunch and they won't like it.
We could protest. But we might want to.
Your stomach lunch. Might protest.
Yeah, that's a good point for me. Okay, so that's good. Perhaps I can start with...
Louise?
Okay, well, let's go in the order as per the programme, and then we'll open up for another round of questions afterwards. Okay, so over to you.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the whole Benjamin reproducibility has led to universal, certainly. Particularly, I mean, Mulroe's museum with a wall, so you know, Voice of Silence. I mean, once you have an image in reproduction, it can be interpreted universally. So there is that element which has created a modernity, even postmodernity. Definitely, lots of other things happen since then. But I'm just wondering, I mean, also today there's this kind of resurgence of the image in iconic turn, as it's called, or pictorial turn, of W.J.T. Mitchell. He's been talking about how there's been a shift away from word to image. Word, of course, semiotics and so on, onto actual direct response to image. So that becomes universal. I think that's linked up with this kind of ubiquity of the image and how it actually circulates. I'm just wondering about one thing. If you have intercultural kind of response, how much of this actually, you know, really is achievable through this kind of universal circulation images? And that's one question. It's a question we might like to respond to. That's what I've been thinking about. How do we do that within that framework? But it's a very good point. I mean, absolutely right. What's happening, the whole tension between, you know, kind of the iconography, image, text, and then the whole kind of direct, you know, response to it, the biological. Okay.
Thank you. Claire, that's a fantastic comment. It's one of those things where I feel like I get back on the train and think, oh yes, no, that's, you know, so much that's interesting has been said. So Claire raised questions about, does it democratise? And I was thinking, does a plurality of aesthetics expand the capacity, the capacity for the political, and if so, how? And for me, this does link to the comments that have been made about being rendered perceptible or imperceptible, and the question of absence, and the question of the hollowing out of content. So I'm not really sure how to respond to all of this. There's so much going on. Thinking about perception, and I've been reading and working around some of Bergson's ideas around perception and memory. And I guess one of the, you know, empirically, one of the things that I'm grappling with is that on the one hand, these kinds of techniques, on the one hand, they have no memory. So in the sense that, you know, we have this imagination of vast databases that can be instantaneously searched, and that's not what happens at all. And in a sense, that this sort of relation that I know that, you know, that Bergson talks about in relation between perception and memory is a very complex one. But it's one in which actually the question about the Jenny raised about content and form really matters. Because, you know, thinking about your brilliant book about missing the person, you know, in one sense, the people writing this code would agree with you, all people are missing already. So there are no fixed identities, the person is always already missing. And then they would say, however, we can have a security intervention even with the person missing. And in fact, actually, the person being missing makes it better, because what we can do is we can say, we don't need a name, we don't need a Cold War-style watch list, we only need a pattern of elements that associate some pieces of a person. You're right, it's not at all the idea of a whole person. It could be one element, and it could be one that we're never conscious of. So actually, you could easily be in the category that, I know you're not really talking about categories, but in terms of thinking about citizens who come to attention or those who are seen as being in danger. In some ways, the dividing practices that operate actually fracture even those kinds of lines, so that somebody's pattern of past travel that was a frequent flyer kind of pattern, in which they experience no form of intervention at all, but some elements of their experiences will become associated with others in order to refine some future code that will then have a specific effect on other future people as they cross the border. So, am I making sense? So some elements of people, things, transactions, objects become associated with others. And then the question about form and content is just such a difficult question, because in a sense it is about, it's about that, what happens in that vacant space. So in the case of the writing of code, what happens in that vacant space is that all kinds of forms of imagination are invited into that space to infer what some future possible threat may be to make it somehow preemptible. So it's what Richard Grusin calls pre-mediation. I'm not sure I agree with him that it's pre-mediated, but that in terms of media is what he would say is happening. So in a sense that kind of content is then inferred. But then what I was trying to show, I think, with Barney Arbidi's work is that there you have also this sense of the person is missing, and actually the thing is missing. We can never fully know it. It's contingent. It could be part of our lives in any number of different ways. How do we know how it can be used, what the possibilities of intervention might be? But there, for me, the difference is that its potentiality remains open to other perceptions, other responses, and other possible future effects. So what happens in that gap of perception and the hollowed out content in the security intervention is that, in effect, all possible future eventualities become actionable in various ways. Whereas in this, I'm not sure about the distinction, but in the use of these particular art practices, what happens is that potential future responses remain open to other possibilities. But I'm not sure how that makes it analogue and digital, and I think we need to talk about it and think about it for some time to kind of work out what that means in relation, for example, to the difference between the analogue and the digital photograph. Marika de Hoorde is doing some work around the presentation of photographs as evidence, of security evidence, and the difference between the digital and the analogue photograph as evidence, and I think that would be interesting also.
Yeah, just picking up on Claire's comments, the reference to Walter Benjamin and the decay of the aura in relation to these spectacular robes, I think it's touching on something that's central to the paper, or central in the sense to the project. It resonated with also debates in the Daily Mail about the expense of these objects, because they each cost £20,000, and they're worn infrequently, so the Daily Mail in its wisdom is all arguing about, oh, what a waste of money. Can get them done more cheaply down the King's Road, but to the same effect. Or when the TV show Judge John Deed was being shown, I think it was the Daily Mail saying that the judicial robes that were worn by the lead character cost something like £500, whereas judicial robes cost £1,500. So why can't they buy them in this other the store? So quite interesting, you know, what place these ceremonial objects have, how they're being understood in terms of, you know, contemporary sense of the role of the state, the role of judicial authority, the value that's attributed to them. And I think that also goes to the question about, well, what happens to authority in the context of the sort of bureaucratic mode of its presentation. And there's a debate, certainly in legal scholarship, around the decline of judges as people that judge, but they manage disputes and manage the resolution of disputes. And I think the picture of Lord Phillips holding his grandson is an interesting question, because I think what you're pointing to is a question that, for example, was explored in portraiture post the birth of the Republic in France, about how you represent bourgeois authority without the symbols that are associated with the sovereign, with aristocracy. And the emergence of the sort of somber portrait of the bourgeois subject, where the face becomes incredibly important as the sign of authority. So, and that also connects to, well, what does authority look like in a republican situation or in a democratic politics, where we have a degree of investment in a decision-making institution that is meant to represent or reflect in some way the polity in all its complexity. And just to pick up on some of the other questions, the really interesting point about the perceptible, and it resonated with issues that came out of the judicial swearing-in speeches being performed in Australia. So Michael Kirby told me about a situation where his partner of 30 years standing had never been mentioned other than in his final retirement speech. And he explained how he would talk about his partner, but in a coded way, and used to sort of dig his relatives in the ribs, saying, oh, or his partner in the ribs, saying, oh, that's a reference to you. So it may be perceptible to him and his partner, but maybe not to other people in the room. And I gave a paper based on the swearing-in speeches to a group of academics and made reference to the mullet, because one of the women that had been appointed to judicial office was a lesbian and talked about how when she first became a barrister she wore a mullet. I was shocked nobody knew what a mullet was and nobody knew what the sexual connotations of the mullet were, which I just sort of took for granted. So, you know, it drew attention to the importance of the audience, the capacity of the audience to read and to hear and to understand, which I think connects to the perceptible. And last but not least, Hogarth. I was struck when Louise was talking about Hogarth, the reference to the serpentine line, which you didn't pick up on, which is a reference to a particular aesthetics, an aesthetics of the Baroque. And that has a particular periodization. I know it's been picked up in terms of the digital block. So there's a question there about, you know, the political economy, the aesthetic tradition, the reproduction of that, the exploitation of that. And the other thing that struck me about in terms of this form and substance, well, of course, Hogarth will be talking about the surface because painting is all about surface. And I think it's thinking about portraiture, the depth of the subject that's being depicted has to be on the surface. The surface has to speak the depth of the subject because the portrait is about identity, it's about the essence of the subject, the soul of the subject. But the soul of the subject, for example, in Hogarthian terms, will be about the gesture of the brushstroke or about the colour of the paint. So, you know, somebody talking, one of the artists I interviewed who'd done a portrait of Michael Kirby, when I met her, turned the portrait on one side and said, that's how I look at the portrait. It's about the colour, it's about the juxtaposition of colours, that's how he's represented, that's how I speak about the depth of the subject. But I take the point that digitalisation, or the analogue, is a different aesthetic, perhaps it produces, it's a different set of marks and gestures that perhaps raises the question about the different form. What can be done or what can't be done in that context.